There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to The Conology, the podcast that looks at life through the films of one of the world's greatest anime filmmakers, Satoshi Kon. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm trying to find the key to unlocking them.
So join us on our quest into the world of Satoshi Kon.
Okay, Michael, it's lovely to be back. We'd normally be inside the Ghibliotech, but we can't really be inside the Conology, but we are at least maybe on chapter two of it. What is going to be on your syllabus for week two?
Well, this is quite a straightforward miniseries. We're going chronologically through the Conology. So straight after Perfect Blue, we're going to cover Millennium Actress, which I know in the last episode, Jake, you said you'd been told was something like the inverse of Perfect Blue. It'd be really interesting to know if that actually bore any truth when you watched the film finally.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of set me up expecting, I'm not even sure, because Perfect Blue is so inverted in itself in the first place. I mean, what's one more inversion on that? It's like adding an 11th loop to a 10 looping roller coaster. I'm not really sure if it was necessary, but yeah, Millennium Actress, it definitely is a film directed by the same guy who made Perfect Blue, that's for sure.
That is factual. And listeners, if you perhaps didn't listen to the Perfect Blue episode, we are going through the four films and one TV series directed by Satoshi Kon in his lifetime. They're a bit different from Ghibli films. They're much more adult. Not necessarily the one we're going to talk about today. Perfect Blue, definitely an 18 rated film. And we've got, you know, darker stuff to come as well, because these are much more complex films, ones without a specific reading that we'll be talking through. We've brought producer Steph Watts on board to bring us another array of opinions while we try and figure out what these complex films actually mean. So Steph, this is of course not your first viewing of Millennium Actress, right?
No, yeah, I've watched it a few times actually. And well, the first few times I tried to watch it, I feel like it's so kind of dreamlike that it just sent me to sleep a couple of times. Not in a bad way.
Well, Lucretia Martel would be happy with you there, Steph.
Exactly. She would say I'm comfortable with the content in the film. I'm not sure how Satoshi Kon would have felt about that, about me falling asleep. But yeah, I've watched it a few times now and I feel like it just gets more and more interesting each time I watch it. I remember saying to you last week, Jake, that I thought you were going to really enjoy this film. So I'm interested to see what you thought of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to talk about with this one. We probably should have been recording the pre-record call that we do as well, because we ended up doing so much chat on it then as well. But I think it is absolutely essential on this series, and probably going forward as well, from what I know about Satoshi Kon, that I'm going to need a synopsis read out of this film, and probably read out again and again, and then I'll watch it two more times, and then after that maybe I'll get a sense of what actually happened. So Steph, what is this film about?
An old film studio goes out of business and is being torn down. Genya Tachibana and his long-suffering cameraman, Kyoji Ida, track down Chiyoko Fujiwara, the studio's best-known star, who is now living as a recluse. When Tachibana gives Chiyoko a key she lost long ago, she reflects on her life, and her memories and the film she starred in become intertwined in a surreal story within a story.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
So, Michael, last week you got us all up to speed with Satoshi Kon from birth to Perfect Blue and everything in between in a concise few minutes. Now, what has happened between Perfect Blue and Millennium Actress?
So we're picking this up in the late 90s. Perfect Blue goes down pretty well. It played well in Japanese cinemas and also international festivals, good reviews as well. So Satoshi Kon was emboldened to continue down this path of innovative experimental storytelling, which was sort of thrust on him by the budgetary requirements, as we talked about in the last episode. Up next, he wanted to make an adaptation of the novel Paprika with the same production studio, Rex Entertainment, but they went bust, so that project went away. However, remember the name Paprika for a future episode. But then a producer called Taro Maki approached Satoshi Kon. He really liked the way that Perfect Blue blurred those lines between fantasy and reality, and he referred to that style as trompe-l'oeil, which is a term from the art world, literally means a trick to the eye, a sort of optical illusion. And, you know, have you ever seen those big sort of street art pieces where an artist has sort of drawn it so it looks like there's some sort of construction where the entire pavement's been dug up and they're just sort of like teetering on the edge of a hole, but actually it's a trick of perspective? That's a sort of more contemporary equivalent of this. And the producer said that Perfect Blue, because of the varying perspectives and the way the film tricks you, that's like a trompe-l'oeil film. Apologies to any French listeners. There's a documentary on the DVD of Millennium Actress where Taro Maki says that a trompe-l'oeil film differs depending on which angle you view it from. So he said to Satoshi Kon, I want to produce your next film if you make another film like that. Which is really interesting, right? So it's not just, let's find another project that was similarly dark and stunning and striking in the way that Perfect Blue was. No, let's just do another one where we can mess with the viewer. And so Kon was intrigued by that. He had a few ideas bubbling around and he settled on this one, Millennium Actress. For this context, I'd like to shout out a few newcomers or returning characters that are behind the scenes. Kon developed the screenplay from his two-line kernel of an idea with the returning screenwriter from Perfect Blue, Sadayuki Murai, although Kon is co-screenwriter with him on this. Also returning from Perfect Blue is Hideki Himasu, the animator, who between those two films went away and worked on both My Neighbors, the Yamadas, and Spirited Away. And later on, pretty much every Ghibli film following, and even on Mary and the Witch's Flower for Studio Ponoc, and then also Your Name. So just basically, he's worked on pretty much every anime that you like from the last 30 years. That starts off this really fascinating thing. If you dig into the credits on every Kon film, there are many animators who would, between Kon projects, go and work with on Ghibli films. A newcomer on Millennium Actress is Toshiyuki Inoue, who had worked previously on Akira and Kiki's Delivery Service in the space of 2 years. You know, no big deal. They'd work with, as would lots of the animation directors and key animators, on many Kon projects to come. Another newcomer behind the scenes is Susumu Hirasawa, the musician, who would go on to be the composer on every Kon film from here on. He was a musician for many years beforehand. Kon was a fan, would listen to his music while writing and working, sort of like art rock, prog rock, multi-genre spanning composer. And he isn't really a traditional composer either in terms of like some of the stylistic choices he makes for Millennium Actress. So the film is premiered in July 2001 at the Fantasia Film Festival in Canada, like Perfect Blue was, and it won the Best Animated Film Award there. It's also played at the Sitges Film Festival, which any sort of genre film fan will tell you is like one of the best festivals in the world for fantasy or horror or any weird stuff like that. So a really great place to situate Kon. It didn't come out in Japan for another year after that, in early 2002. It also had a small release in the States later in 2002. It was well received. It got good reviews from critics and it picked up a few end of year awards in Japan. It didn't come out in the UK, and it didn't come out until 2005 when it went straight to DVD. And if you think about the timeline there, Millennium Actress didn't come out in the UK in terms of in a wide way until both Tokyo Godfathers and Paranoia Agent, the TV series, had been released in the UK. So this for many years was almost seen as the missing piece of the puzzle for Kon fans. And because of that, it's developed a bit of a reputation as something of a hidden gem in its filmography. But I suppose the big question, Jake, is this a hidden gem in your eyes?
So, Jake, you said when you sat down to watch this film, you could immediately tell that it was by the same director. What was the first clue?
Well, it's right in the first 30 seconds of the film. As with Perfect Blue, we open with a kind of sci-fi genre-y piece in the very beginning. In Perfect Blue, it was that kind of Gundam, Power Rangers-y type anime. And here we start in a rocket ship battle among the stars type film. In fact, I'm convinced that the opening shot of this is a direct reference to Star Wars. It features a looking down on a planet and a slow moving spaceship that takes up most of the screen moving across the sky. And then a circle within a circle on a moon shaped star base. If that's not a Death Star reference, I don't know what is. But we have this world, and I think, oh, this is very cool. No one told me it's a space film. But they did tell me that it's a Satoshi Kon film. So, of course, this is not the film I'm watching. This is just a film within the film that I'm watching. And then we're dragged back from this into our own reality. But, of course, there's an earthquake sound in the film, and then there's an earthquake sound in our reality, and we're starting to blend all of these things together. And I think, oh yeah, okay, right, we're right at home here. It's like, this is like when I switch on a Ghibli and there's a nice blue sky and a green field. Okay, I understand where I am again.
Something I love about the opening sequence of this film is there's a wonderful train journey to the countryside in daylight, which is almost like a Ghibli film.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be a bit weird if Ghibli made this film, but I mean, there's some stuff that we can recognize.
And I wonder, Jake, I really liked how you put it in the previous episode about how this fractured, non-linear, overlapping style of storytelling that Con develops around Perfect Blue that he brings over to this film. I think he perfects in this film, where no scene really ends traditionally. This free-flowing structure, scenes just tumble in one into the next. I wonder, did you respond to that in this film as well?
Yeah, absolutely. The momentum of this film is phenomenal. It just doesn't stop. And not in a Safdie Brothers type way, where it is all claustrophobia and sweat and anxiety. This is deploying some of the tactics that animation can give you that live action can't, to just keep you wrapped in a story. And that you're not doing trick camera matches to carry on a scene a la Birdman or something like that. You are just overlapping and overlapping and overlapping and constantly just keeping your viewer engaged. I suppose it's, would it be more like a tapestry than the scrapbook that Perfect Blue might be, where it is like almost violent in that editing style?
That's a very beautiful way of putting it, Jake. I think you might have already answered this question that I had for you, which I almost want to ask with pretty much everything we're going to talk about in this miniseries. And it's about, when did you realise that we were going to be blurring fact and fiction so much? So we have the opening where it's the film within a film, but that film is on a TV set in the very, very well-designed, detailed studio gaff of that director. So many VHS just kind of tapes piled on top of each other. And then they're going to somewhere to shoot this documentary. There's a bit of trickery early on that I love, where you have that wide shot of the demolition of the studio, and he's recording the VO, and then the camera pans a bit too far and you see him in shot and he goes, no, this is meant to be VO. You know, lots of playful stuff there. But when they finally go and meet the actress, and she goes, oh, this takes me all the way back to when I was a child and I wanted to become an actress. And already we have this intermingling of the film world and her own biography. Whenever I've watched this film, that's usually when I twig, oh, this is what the film's going to be. There's going to be this intertwining of fact and fiction. But you said you were onto it from the beginning.
I think I clued it. Like, as soon as you see the cameraman within the memory or the scene, which is which, then I kind of got what was going on there. But I think he plants the seeds of it early on as well, like even in the pre-titles, in the titles, and even lines of dialogue, like over that shot of the destroyed studio saying, this can't be the opening. You're getting all of this stuff that makes you feel like you need to prepare for questioning the reality that you're going to be in. And I thought, in this case, it's more elegantly done than Perfect Blue, I think. I don't think Perfect Blue wants to be elegant, but Perfect Blue is wanting to pull that rug from under you because it wants you to get inside her head and to have that fear of your own reality to just be ripped away from you. And Perfect Blue is really smart for that. But this isn't about psychosis and fracturing mentality. This is, for me, about memory and the way that you can absolutely drift into a memory and come back out of it through the process of storytelling. And that is how I think we see this storytelling and editing style that has been applied to one thing in Perfect Blue, given a totally different context, but it's ultimately the same style and has a totally different effect.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting watching this film so close to Perfect Blue and seeing those same techniques used for a completely different reason. Like, and I think also the placing of Tachibana and his cameraman in those scenes is really clever, because you're then putting them in the position that we were in watching Perfect Blue. So they're the kind of confused, disorientated viewers, and we get to sit back and take in the whole picture, and we can kind of see the inner workings of what's going on. And so, yeah, it's a completely different effect from Perfect Blue, but using the same techniques. It's really interesting.
It's really impressive. And I think that the cameraman, as much as he is a great bit of light relief throughout, he's a great surrogate for us as an audience to kind of not take those transitions that seriously in the way we might have done in Perfect Blue. Like when they're in Manchuria and then you're about to be like piling through a train, but then you actually are in the middle of a samurai film. And he actually says, what happened to Manchuria? And so he's asking those questions so we don't have to. And just by giving us that relief, letting us know that we don't need to be as aware as we might have been in the previous film.
I think he really highlights the lengths that cinema can go to as well. The fact that you can just change period, you can just change location like that, just with editing, and you're suddenly in a completely different world. Is the magic of cinema. So he's answering those questions for us.
Yeah, it's a real love letter. And there's lots of references here that I'm sure people's eyes will be lighting up who are more familiar with classic Japanese cinema. But there's lots of references here for the fans, aren't there, Michael?
Oh, there really are. And I think possibly the two, well, certainly the one that is easiest to spot, because I suppose the film is one of the ones more widely watched over here, would be Throne of Blood. That, as you called it, the samurai sequence, where she opens the door and she's on a train in Manchuria, but now she's in a palace that's under attack and going to have a chat with an old witch. There's an actual shot where it's the poor cameraman who has all the arrows fired at him, which is restaging the iconic shot from Throne of Blood, which is Akira Kurosawa's take on Macbeth, where it's Toshiro Mifune, you know, with all of the arrows in him. That's there. But this is the way that he's playing with film history. In interviews, I think, and in Andrew Osman's book, there's a lot of chat about how that side of it, the journey through Japanese cinema side of the film, is almost overstated because it's something that apparently Western critics are latched onto. And Satoshi Kon says that he's by no means an expert in Japanese cinema. In fact, he, you know, likes watching, you know, Terry Gilliam films and films from the West. So he often had to go and watch a lot of these films himself to pick these scenes out. But it does add this extra aspect to the film. As you say, Steph, about the magic of cinema, there's so much we can talk about, and already I feel like we're splintering off in many different directions. But there is something about using a famous star, in this case, the star that was an icon for a very specific amount of time and then went into hiding or seclusion or early retirement, and how she, because she lives on in our memory as this actress in films that we love and rewatch, is therefore this emblem of a time and a period and a culture across the decades. The actress in the film is based on a couple of real life actresses, one being Setsuko Hara, who is in Yasujiro Ozu's films. They in fact actually recreate a scene from Tokyo Story with her in. But in some ways, you're not supposed to almost invest in who this actress is, because we are seeing it from the point of view of the director, who is a huge fan of her work. And this is him bringing almost another aspect from Perfect Blue over. It's how a fan and the fan's projection of the fan object, the star in this case, not the idol from the last film, that's the relationship we're seeing played out on screen.
But it's a much softer relationship than it is in Perfect Blue. In Perfect Blue, we're seeing the worst of fandom right there. And it's like prescient for the experiences that a lot of famous people have today. And this guy and the star, their relationship is more tender and seems to be understanding. And she's not afraid or anything like that. And it's a trip down memory lane for both of them, really. He's remembering the performances and watching them, and she's remembering living them. And to me, she is picking out scenes and memories and telling them to him because those are the ones that were most affecting for her because of how they tie to her own life. And so for me, the read on the film was in a way an exploration of actor auteur theory, and that we were seeing a lot of these performances that, even though the films that they are in are markedly different and the genres are different and the makeup is different, the character has this similarity because we're seeing them in these moments linked to her lost love. And they're the most powerful for her because they all stem back to this key and this romance. And that's actually a whole area of this film that we haven't even spoken about yet. And so putting the travel through Japanese cinema aside, what do we think of the treasure hunt romance side of it?
I think the key could mean so many things. She's first given it when she's kind of a young teenager. She hides a rebel who's running away from the police in her cellar, and he gives her this key, and she says, like, "What is this?" And he's like, "It's the most important thing there is," and then kind of disappears for the rest of her life. And she's always trying to find him again, and she's using this key as the one connection she has to him. And I guess on one level, that is what the key is. It's like her memory of him, and her reminder that he's out there and that she could find him. And then it has so many other metaphorical ideas behind it that could mean any number of things. I mean, for one thing, it just drives the film. It's the catalyst for the whole film to play out, for one thing. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
So this is where my sort of, I fly off and have a bit of a galaxy brain reading of this film. You say that it's more elegant in the way that it weaves together fact and fiction compared to Perfect Blue, which was a much more sort of harsh, harrowing film. However, I think this is a more intellectual film than emotional one. So when we ask what actually is happening in this film, I think it is less interested in the characters at play, their emotional relationships, the real story of this lost love that she has, and it all is because of that key. And that key, I think, it represents everything in terms of it's the key to the story, literally so. It's the MacGuffin, it's the rosebud, it's the Madeleine cake from Proust. It's the thing that drives everything forward. It's there in every film in some way, or in every incident in her life, as that lost lover is, or some ghost of the lost lover, because narrative, storytelling, our emotional relationship with cinema is driven by wanting to find something. And this feeds into another aspect of this film, which is the fact that she's always running, she's always chasing something, looking for something, as the director is always looking for an answer that he finally gets, but it's almost separate from the conclusion to the film when he finds out what happens to that long lost lover. Millennium Actress is a film about cinema. It's about the actress talking about her life through her movies, but we're also seeing the movies and the movie industry played out through her life, through the movies. And within that, we're looking at why we are so enthralled by cinema. Name a genre. Your mystery, your romance, your thrills, your comedy, all of these require some sort of lack, some sort of search, some sort of journey. And that's what we see when some incredible sequences here where she's going from from a drama to a post-war landscape to Throne of Blood to a Zatoichi type samurai ninja action film. All these things are being united by that search for something. And when she says that she is chasing shadows, couldn't that be a description of what we're doing when we see lights reflected off the screen, searching for an experience? And that's what cinema is. That's my galaxy brain reading. And please completely undermine that, Jake.
I would not dream of undermining that. I think that's a really lovely way of reading the film, but I just don't think that way of reading it comes through the first time that you watch it. And I apologize if I'm being an idiot there. But I think I can see how this film rewards you the more you go back to it. But I think the first time that you're watching it, because it does flutter around between all of these different things, as a viewer, you latch on to the plot that you can get, and that there is this thread that is quite easy to grasp at the start of lost love, and in a odd biopic way, going through someone's life in search of that. That is a very simple through line that sits on top of all of the subtext there. And for me, maybe because it was focusing on ideas that you suggest there that are more in the realm of the intellectual than the emotional, it didn't give me much payoff in the end. And Steph, I wonder if this is the kind of thing that you were suggesting last week about why I might like the film. Because there is like within the first 30 minutes, like I was like scribbling stuff down. Like, I love this. I love this. I love this. Like, is this a treasure hunt film? Is this a romance film? Love it. I'm a sucker for a romance, as we established across 30 Ghibli episodes. But this never came together in the final act to reward any investment that you might have in that side of the story. But I can absolutely appreciate the other reading of it. Steph, you can now undermine me and tell me why you think it does work.
Well, I think I do agree with that. The first time you watch it, you kind of grasp onto anything that seems familiar and seems to make sense, which would be this romantic through line and the characters. But then I think, yeah, rewatching it and thinking about it, it is more of a kind of love letter to cinema and to a country looking at their past through the medium of film and how that is kind of portrayed on film. Because you go through her life in 20th century Japan, but then she's also going through way earlier in Japanese history through film. So I think the film feels more about that. And then that kind of final line, the after all it was the chase that I really loved, can refer to that, her just wanting to chase the long lost lover with the key. But it's also that the chase in film, like the earliest films were chase films. You think about like why something like Mad Max Fury Road was just this kind of simple chase film, and that is kind of what is at the heart of a lot of cinema. And I think that final line really just encapsulates the whole feeling of the film. Also, I thought you were going to like it because I feel like James Gray might have watched this film when he was writing Ad Astra. And that kind of end, blast off into space, into the unknown, to reckon with herself and people that she's been chasing her entire life. That feels very Brad Pitt reckoning with his dad who's just gone off to Saturn. I can see that.
But I didn't think we'd be getting into Ad Astra spoilers at this point. I suppose it was inevitable. But I think what's wonderful about Ad Astra is that it flips the identity of what a lot of space exploration films are about, and that they're so often about the kind of colonialist figure going out into space and claiming it, and the joy of exploration. And James Gray films will look at exploration, particularly in The Lost City of Zed and Ad Astra, and just see that there is cannot be that much value in that compared to what you have at home and the people that are there and the life that is there. And that is why I found the ending of Ad Astra so powerful. And to me, that final line, because I wasn't so invested in the romance of it all, I felt like it betrayed some of the storytelling logic. Because then I thought, well, if it was all about the chase, then why did you stop? Why did you go into hiding for 30 years? and Michael, you might suggest, because she literally lost the key. And so if she doesn't have the key, she's got nothing to chase. And that's where you're going to... And I'm sure this is the joy of Satoshi Kon films. And we can do this podcast in a year's time and I'll watch it again and we'll do a totally different reaction to it.
Well, this is something. So I've seen it several times. And right in the middle of that was a time that I saw it at the cinema where they played it at the Barbican Centre in London from a really beautiful print. And that was the viewing of it that really opened my eyes to the film. And I wouldn't, it will eventually come out. There's a really nice new HD version of the film that will eventually come out in the UK, I hear. So we should take you to see it, Jake, have a camera trained on you for the whole film and see if something sparks. But okay, just to take on board what you're saying, Jake, I think the reason why I'm pushed in this intellectual direction to really go deep on the storytelling postmodern aspects here is probably because I think there isn't as much on that story. I do think there's a flaw at the heart of it. Just something as simple as with Perfect Blue, we knew what happened. We knew what the actual factual case was, even though we were watching things play out from a psyche that was fracturing before our eyes. By the end, we knew that it was this character and people putting pressures on her. The stalker was being manipulated by the assistant, who was actually, you know, the real force for evil. We don't have that objective anchor point in this film. And maybe I'm focusing on this too much because we're doing this chronology, watching all the films back to back, and this is one aspect that fascinates me, is that when you say what actually happened in the 1920s to the 1950s in her life, what we know that there may have been this man and he went away and then later on, you know, he was tortured and died, and we have a couple of these snatches, but when in these long sequences where it's playing with the films telling her life and her life being told through the films, what we're seeing is this midpoint between her memories, her films, and the fans' projection of that. And when they start interacting within the scenes and he starts trying to change the way the scenes play out, where he appears as a supporting character, that's so fun in the moment. But I find it almost impossible to decode what the actual factual plot line is happening in front of us. And that's what makes me think of films like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, where you're going into memory, but you have actors within that memory recreating new memories or memories that never existed. But then also there are those sequences where you have Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet's characters watching the memories happen in front of them and commenting on it. So it's all these multiple levels, but we don't have a firm footing in reality, which is, yeah, quite brain bending. And that's why I think that this inevitably is, for me, a much more complex film to understand than Perfect Blue. And it's the fact that it's like 80 odd minutes as well. Yeah, it doesn't do much to go on.
It's amazing. and in that respect, it is incredible. And I think you're right that without that sure footing, the impact that the film can have on you is lacking. I also think there's the big issue for any connection to it is there's a lack of character depth to her, because I mean, I can ask you both this question: beyond loving this guy, who is she?
Well, I think it's kind of less about her having that character, because Tachibana, the director, knows her as this actress, and we, the viewer, only know her as this actress. I think it's kind of confronting how we have relationships with actors and celebrities, because I think while it's not overly emotional in the sense that something like Perfect Blue is, where we feel like we know Mima, when an actor that kind of represents a generation of cinema dies, you get that almost that loss of that history with them. It's like they're never gonna make something else, they're never gonna live that new kind of life in a new film again. That feels like what they're going for with her death to me. And the way that we know her is through her films, so we're not gonna know her on this personal level because we're held at arm's length by the film, so we're only getting to know her through the roles that she's played, and that is pretty similar for a lot of celebrities and actors of that kind of age that we know now.
It's about cinema, Jake. I'm doing a well. How do you describe this hand movement?
There's just so much. There was another version of this conversation where we can talk about how it's actually all about animation, and that's why the suitcase, which is implied, the key opens, seems to be filled with paint, and there's so much conversation about painting and how live action is painting with cameras, but animation is actually painting, in which an animated film with a live action character, and this could go on and on, and I really should put that all aside because we haven't talked about Susumu Hirasawa and what he's been up to on those synthesizers, because the man conducted a hell of a score.
Yeah, I love the score. I love how wild it is. You're going through so many different types and genres of music. I love all the little refrains that keep coming back. I think the first time she meets the painter is like my favorite bit of music. But Jake, I know you love the bit where they're riding on horses and this synth music starts kind of blaring out, completely different from the era that it's supposed to be in.
That's it. I would love it to see what he was writing as he was watching those scenes. It's like, okay, right, so we've got traditional samurai outfits. It's like this lovely landscape and there's fire. And it seems like it's like a very classical battle scene. It's like, okay, get the marauder out. We're going hard. This is exactly what this needs right now. A wild, wild score that I really, really enjoyed.
I'm glad you're loving his work so far, Jake, because some of his best, most over-the-top music is still to come. So sit tight.
So, Jake, we've watched two Satoshi Kon films now, and while it wouldn't be much of a list so far, if you were going to rank them in the popularity contest, what's going first and what's going second?
Okay. I think that this is quite easy for me, just because I think it was just such a tighter piece, and I think your first time experiencing something and a new director is always going to be so exciting, and like seeing this style play out for the first time rather than the second time is a bit more impactful. So I've got to put, based on current watches, Perfect Blue at the top and Millennium Actress second. Would that be the same for both of you?
Well, I think I'd have to agree. They're both 5-star films, really, or close to 5-star films in my estimation. However, rewatching them both for this, I think Perfect Blue edges it. It's an uglier film, a more grotesque film. Millennium Actress is a bit more elegant, as we've said, but Perfect Blue, I think, takes you on more of a ride. Steph?
Yeah, I think I would have to agree. Although I think it is really close for me. Like every time I rewatch Millennium Actress, I get something new out of it, and I feel like it is a much quieter and more gentle film than Perfect Blue, but it has just as much to say and it's just as kind of complex.
Final word on this, Jake. Do you think these films work as a double bill?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Really good double bill. And if I were to throw in a third feature into that, that makes things a bit more, even more child friendly, throw in the Martin Scorsese film Hugo, because if there's another film out there that involves someone discovering a key that takes them on an adventure that ends in a love letter for cinema, that's the one to watch.
Martin Scorsese loves his cinema. So next episode, this is possibly the most jarring hairpin turn, I think, of the series. Steph, you might disagree with me. What do you think?
No, I feel like it's definitely the odd one out in the back catalogue.
So this is Tokyo Godfathers. Steph, can we give Jake anything to go on, a crumb to go on for until next week?
I think we can tell you it's a Christmas movie.
We're currently experiencing 30-degree heat in the UK. Christmas time.
Oh, I'm very, very excited. Purely because, I mean, it's got to be... actually, in a way, if I love it, it's going to be frustrating, because then I would have wanted to call this podcast Tokyo Podfathers. Let's just hope it's terrible.
Well, we'll have to find out next week. Until then, keep up with us on Twitter at Ghibliotech, or send us an email. The mailbag is open at ghibli@little.studios.com. Or you could keep up with us individually. You can follow Jake at Jake H. Cunningham.
You can follow Steph at _Steph Watts.
And you can follow Michael at Michael J. Leader. Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is made by Anthony Ng. Our artwork is by Sophie Moe. And Jamie Maisner is our audio wizard. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Steph Watts, and Harold McShiel. Hi everyone, thanks for sticking through the credits. Now, Millennium Actress had a whole host of talented animators behind it, including the animation director, Kenichi Konishi, who animated one of the earthquake scenes. Now, he had a stint at Studio Ghibli before working with Satoshi Kon, and he worked on some pretty iconic scenes. He animated No Face chasing Chihiro through the bathhouse in Spirited Away, and he animated the violin recital of Country Roads in Whisper of the Heart.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.